All right. Good afternoon, everybody. It's a huge pleasure to be here. KITP has had a huge role in my life, and I really am so grateful that this place exists. In biology, there's a place called the Marine Biological Laboratory, and I often tell people that KITP is the MBL of physics. It's really absolutely fantastic. So this is my third time giving a chalk talk. It's always an exercise in public humility for exactly the reason that Lars said. You have people in the audience that know more about the subject than you do, and then you also have people in the audience that maybe don't remember the difference between a protein and a nucleic acid, which is what I was at when I decided to switch fields. So I'm going to try and thread that needle. I ask your forbearance. I'm going to practice a little bit of crowd control. I've been here many, many times. I understand that there's questions. I'm going to try to be brief in my answers and volunteer myself morning, noon, and night to talk to anybody about anything in great detail. So at any rate, one of the things that I've learned in these talks is that not only can you not fool Mother Nature, you also can't fool David Gross. So I was standing right here doing a very beautiful calculation with a random walk, and it was beautiful, but I indeed made a little factor of two error, and he was on top of it, despite being in the middle of eating. So here's the outline. So what I want to do is I want to start out by telling you what is this thing, cellular energetics. And then I'm going to spend some time on what does the energy associated with cellular energetics purchase? And this is the answer. I drew it ahead of time because it would take me too long to make the drawings, but I'm going to do a lot of calculations along the way. Then I'm going to more briefly say what biology needs that physics has, and I will close with what physics needs that biology has. And I hope that I will convince you that both of those are reasonable propositions. The goals for the talk: first of all, I'd really love to argue, and hopefully even better yet, convince you that the flow of energy in living matter constitutes a really cool frontier area of physics. And in fact, it's not really a frontier. If you go back and read your history of thermodynamics, you'll hear about a guy called Julius Robert Meyer. He was a German physician. He, before Joule, had already calculated and published the mechanical equivalent of heat, and he did it right. And he ended up in an insane asylum. He was a German doctor. and he went to the tropics, and he noticed something about the color of blood, and the color of blood being different in the tropics. And if you can imagine, that led him, through some tortured thinking, to the notion of conservation of energy. But, you know, this is old news that living matter is really interesting. Joseph Priestley, Antoine Lavoisier, these guys were super careful about trying to measure gases and understand about the different kinds of air, to use Priestley's language. You know, he's the guy who discovered oxygen and so on. So at any rate, I'm going to try and convince you of that. And then I hope that I will capture your imagination with some beautiful and mysterious, at least for now, phenomena. I'm going to try to do the golden rule of talk giving, which is I'm going to try and give you the talk that I would like to hear if I were sitting there eating my lunch and I didn't know what was going on in the other program. Yes, I took quantum mechanics, I love magnetism, whatever, but I probably forgot everything. I might know how to diagonalize a 2x2 matrix. So, you know, I would need you to tell me stuff, okay, and not pretend like I'm an expert, all right? And so for those of you that are in the program, Lars already said it, but I'm going to reiterate, you know, like, teaching is controlled lying. There's sometimes when you say things that are little, you know, half-truths, and I'm going to pursue that a little. Okay, so what is cellular energetics? So here's a question for everybody. Who is more powerful on a per kilogram basis, David Gross or the sun? It's a serious question. I mean, I'm going to calculate it, but I want to know. And by what factor?
Okay. What's your unit?
I said powerful per kilogram.
Ergs per second per gram.
Yeah, although that, I'm not going to deal with these erg things. I teach a course with Dave Stevenson, and he's always using this stuff and saying God's units, and it's just so annoying. So I'm going to use MKS, if you don't mind. All right, so here's the first thought, is you guys are eating. If you're eating appropriately, we're going to say that you're taking on board 2,000 kcals per day. And for my purposes, that is the same as 4,000 joules. If we can adjust that a little bit, but that's roughly 10 to the 7th joules per day. And then I can multiply that by 1 day is 10 to the 5 seconds, and that gives me 100 watts. And that shouldn't surprise anybody, because you should kind of be used to the idea if 10 of us get in a small room, it starts to work, that you keep each other warm. Okay, so we're about one light bulb. And so the power per mass is something like 100 watts divided by 100 kilograms, which is more or less perfectly my weight, which is 1 watt per kilogram. So that's David. Okay. Now, what about the sun? So for the sun, what I would say is we know that in this beautiful day where I'm wearing shorts and it's winter and I'm gloating, we have 1,000 watts per square meter, roughly, incident outside. And then I'm going to multiply that by the surface area of a sphere of 10 to the ninth, 150 times 10 to the ninth meters squared. And then I should put in a 4 pi. So incident power, area of this giant sphere, and this thing is going to give me a 225. This is going to give me, a 10 to the 20th. This is 10. And so I'm going to get few times 10 to the 26 watts as the power of the sun. Now, I feel like I really would love to calculate for you the mass of the sun, okay? And the way I would do it is I would use the speed of the Earth, I would use the distance, and I would use capital G. I'm always curious what I could figure out on a desert island without knowing anything. And you could do it, but I'm not going to do it because I don't have time. But the mass of the sun is something like 2 times 10 to the 31 kilograms, so somebody can correct me if I'm wrong, and that's telling me that the power per mass is something on the order, let's just call it 10 to the minus 5.
Should be
10
to the 30 kilograms.
I don't know. Okay. I don't know anymore because now I'm in front of all of you and you're staring at me. But I feel like this is what I got. But does somebody know off the top of their head for real?
No, it should be 10 to the 33 grams, so it's 10 to the 30 kilograms.
Okay. All right.
Whatever.
So.
The point's still valid.
Yes. Right. 10 to the minus 4, maybe. And for a bacterium, this could be as much as a factor of 1,000 larger. So 1,000 watts per kilogram. So at any rate, that's cool, that's amusing. Now, what I want to do is let's figure out how many ATP equivalents this is equal to. So ATP is the energy currency of the cell. There are other ways to get energy, but for my purposes, I'm going to talk only in terms of ATP equivalents. So let's see, I have 10 to the 7th joules per day, and then I know that 1 kBT is 4 times 10 to the minus 21 joules. And and then 1 ATP is worth about 20 kBT. So I want to show you all those conversion factors. So this one's the most important. ATP is the $20 bill of the cell. If you could carry around a particular denomination, if I were going to give you $1 million and told you only were going to spend cash from here on, I thought you, but I would want to have 20s. I wouldn't want 1s, that's annoying. I wouldn't want 1,000s or 100s because you go to the store and you pull it out and they're going to look at you cross-eyed. So the bottom line is 20 KT is a very interesting number as an energy unit because, you know, DNA, for example, is right, it's teetering on melting. Right here and now, you know, hydrogen bonds, and that's a couple of KTs. And so ATP is a little bit above, but not too much. So so this tells me 10 to the 28th divided by roughly 100, and that's ATPs per day. Okay, I took 4 times 20, I called it 100. So 10 to the 7, 10 to the 20, 10 to the 21, that gives me 10 to the 28th. So this is roughly 10 to the 26th ATPs per day. And finally, just for amusement, let's convert that into a mass. So this is, so I have 10 to the 26th ATPs per day. And then, let's see. So 1 mole is 6 times 10 to the 23rd ATPs. And finally, I have 300 grams per mole. And this is going to be roughly 50 kilograms. And I have the prize. Why am I telling you this? I'm telling you that the amount of ATP being churned out every day, there's little molecular machines. I like to think of it every time I'm on an airplane. When the airplane goes onto the runway, I don't know how many of you have looked, but if you're lucky and you sit in business class and you choose a window seat, you'll be able to see the little white spiral still when the airplane goes onto the runway. Then the pilot takes the thrust to max, and at that point, that engine is turning exactly the same rate as ATP synthase, which is 100 hertz. 100 turns per second, 300 ATPs being generated by every little molecular machine every second. And I'm trying to say that if you like, if you add up all of those ATPs, it comes out to about 50 kilograms, something like that. Okay, so why do I tell you all this?
You just phosphorylate them.
Sorry?
You don't really make
them. I hate that word, just. Such a KITP word. I don't know. Boris, come on. Break. There is indeed a cool molecular machine that the evolutionary deniers are so excited about, you know, that it's like impossible to be a product of evolution. I don't know if you're trying to make a point or if you're just giving me a hard time. But, okay, I don't know what your point is, but my point is this. A lot of energy goes into being a human being or a living organism or whatever. That's all I really wanted to say. I was trying to amuse you. So I should have said who's more powerful, Boris or David. One other thing I want to say is that for a bacterium, this number, so bacterium has a volume of about 1 micron cubed, which is the same as 10 to the minus 15 liters, and it's basically synthesizing 10 to the 6th ATPs in every micron cubed of material per second. That's the rate at which ATP is being synthesized inside of a little teeny tiny bacterium. Okay, so that's the end of part one. What is cellular energetics? I hope I've just given you at least a little bit of a sense that it costs to be us. Okay, and I don't know, maybe Boris doesn't like the way I measure it. I still like it. I'm amused by this. There's a lot of ATP synthesized per day. I don't know, if you don't like that, then you can think about how many moles it is. It's a lot. So, what is the energy used to do? What is the energy purchase? So now I'm going to tell you about all these diagrams that I've made. So one of the key things that the energy is used to do is to create concentration gradients. So cells are always at a different concentration of ions than the external world. There's a factor of 20, for example, on potassium. There's a factor of like 10 to the 4th on calcium. So there are huge gradients. And if you did not have little pumps in the cell membrane that maintain that gradient, then the gradient would run down over time. So energy is expended in the form of maintaining these gradients. And one of the things that I guess I find amusing is, you know, I like the story of Humpty Dumpty, which I'll remind you of. Humpty, it's a short autobiography. Humpty Dumpty sat on a wall. Humpty Dumpty took a great fall. All the king's horses and all the king's men couldn't put Humpty together again, or something like that. So if I showed you a movie of Humpty Dumpty's life and ran it backwards, you'd say to me, dude, you know, you're running the movie backwards. But the thing is, if I showed you this movie, this is T equals zero, and this is T equals tomorrow, you might say, hey, you did the Humpty Dumpty trick on me. And I would say, no, I didn't. That's what cells do. That's their job description. They have pumps whose job it is to push concentration so that you end up with gradients. And just as a little aside, I can tell you that the delta G associated with this, we can estimate as KBT log of Cn over C out, which I could always do as KBT log of 10 to the n, just think about 10 n-fold differences, 10 to the n-fold differences. So that would be n KBT log 10, which is 2.3. So basically, every 10-fold is worth 2.3 KTs. So you could see that if I'm interested in having a 10 to the 4th fold, then that's going to be 10 KTs worth of delta G that needs to be invested. So that's example number one. Example number two, macromolecular synthesis. I don't know how everyone felt, but you know, I've taught freshman biology at Caltech 10 times. We always do a survey because it's forced on them. It's freshman biology for non-biology majors. Every kid at Caltech has to take physics, math, biology, chemistry. No questions asked, no arguing, no group, you know, complain, but that's about it. So I always do a survey and I say, A, I'm stoked to be in this class. B, I will tolerate it. C, this is the worst class that I'm ever going to take in my life, and it's almost always a delta function on C. So why? Because they were taught that biology is some sort of a memorization thing, and it's some sort of a subject lacking principles, and they were told to memorize names and so on. But in fact, there's really interesting stuff to think about. What's happening in your guts right now after eating and after the food is being digested, and what's happening to the water content in your intestine and so on. So at any rate, molecules are getting synthesized all the time. There's a little machine known as the ribosome whose job it is to take the information contained in an mRNA molecule and to turn it into a sequence of amino acids, which we call a protein. So that's number two. Number three, or two prime, I forgot about it when I was drawing this, is a slogan from a guy at Harvard named Jeremy Gunawardena. And I really love this. Escape genetic imprisonment. What does that mean? If you think about it, the genetic code in our DNA codes for about 20,000 different proteins. And yet you have really 10 to the 9th, 10 to the 12th different antibodies, just for example. So how do you get that kind of diversity? Another way of saying it is that every E. coli cell has proteins, and basically every protein is distinct because, as Boris just said, you can add or subtract a phosphate group. And the combinatorial complexity or the combinatorial explosion is enormous. So great energy is invested in putting chemical groups onto proteins. Here I'm showing you one of my favorite examples. In every one of your cells, you have 2 meters worth of DNA. You have on the order of few times 10 to the 13th cells in your body. Over the course of your lifetimes, us, the three of us, I will say, you, me, and Boris, we have already synthesized a light year worth of DNA in our bodies at this age. So there's all this DNA. There's 1 meter worth of DNA, 2 meters worth of DNA in every 5-micron nucleus. I don't know, you gotta think about that. It's a little hard to wrap your head around. So the DNA is packed by being wrapped onto spools known as histones, histone octamers. And these things get modified. So there's constant modification. There's measurement and modification of proteins to change their functional response. That's example number 2'. Next, high fidelity polymerization. This one's one of my favorites. So the bottom line is that every time the cell divides, the DNA has to be copied. The question is, with what fidelity? There's a beautiful analogy made by Tanya Baker, so let me run it by you. Imagine that DNA had this diameter, so 1 meter. Okay, that's the diameter. Then the complex that copies the DNA would be the size of a FedEx truck. It would be traveling at a speed of 500 kilometers per hour. It would be making a delivery on both sides of the street every roughly 10 centimeters. It would finish its journey in 40 minutes, and it would mistakenly deliver a package once every 3 years. That is DNA replication fidelity. If you're an engineer, go engineer for me. Like, that's serious. I just say it again. 500 kilometers per hour, delivery on both sides of the street every 10 centimeters, 40-minute journey, one mistake in delivery once every 3 years. That's the thing to have in mind. So there's a very, very low error rate. So a great calculation was done. It was done by John Hopfield and Jacques Mignot in about 1970. They did exactly what you might imagine, is they said, well, let's ask Boltzmann. What would Boltzmann say about the error rate? So the answer to that is to imagine, so here I've got a tRNA that's going to bind onto an mRNA, and this is the right one. And then here I've got a second tRNA, and it's not the right one. So let's represent that by this being a mismatch here. So this is not the right the right guy. So the calculation was P wrong divided by P right. So I'm simply asking, what would be the discrimination that I would get strictly from equilibrium thinking? And you know, this is of order some e to the minus delta epsilon, and this is a few hydrogen bonds. It's a few, I don't know, few kts. But that means e to the few, which is 10, or e to the too few, which is 100. But it's certainly not 10 to the minus 10. It's not even 10 to the minus 4, which is the error rate in translation. I asked Hopfield. I mean, I'm not just making this up. I said, I'm imagining that you did this calculation, and it didn't hold water. And so this led to this idea of what's called kinetic proofreading. I'm not going to go into it, but it's super cool and worth thinking about. And biology is full of examples of proofreading. This is the quietest KITP talk in my life. I don't mean for me as a speaker. I mean, period.
We're not making enough.
I'm going to tell you a story that Yanni Kondev told me. So there, often the southern part of countries is where you think the dumb and slow people are. So he's from former Yugoslavia. I won't say which place. But at any rate, this family had this kid. The kid was 7 years old, had never said a word. And finally, one night at dinner, he looks over at his mom and he says, could you please pass the salt? And her mom, the mom was just completely flabbergasted, like, what is going on? We thought you didn't know how to talk. And he said, I didn't have any complaints. So I'm going to interpret, over-interpreting, I'm going to interpret, you have no complaints. All right, next, construct statistically stable structures. So surely many of you have seen pictures of cells dividing and the chromosomes being segregated to opposite sides of the newly born cells. This structure is awesome and insane. And you know, one of my main hang-ups in my life in science, in my life in academia, in life in general, is it just bugs me when people take stuff for granted. So, you know, one time I got upgraded to international first class in a 747. I was going back from Europe, sitting in the front, had the window open because I wanted to look at the Berkshires of Greenland. And this woman right there, she pressed her button and the flight attendant came over and she said, I'm trying to watch this movie. Could you please tell that gentleman that I'm trying to watch a movie? So she came over here and I said, I'm looking at Greenland. If you had asked Isaac Newton if he could fly in a tube at nearly the speed of sound and look out a window at another continent, he probably would pay money. You know, like, no, I'm not going to put my window down. So, you know, it's easy to take this for granted. But I don't know, Dan, you tell me if you're offended by what I'm going to say, but I don't think we really understand this very well. You okay with that?
I'm cool with that.
Okay, so you know, like, what do we do in physics? We see cool, complicated, mysterious phenomena, and we try to figure it out. So that's a good one. Okay, next. Socks before shoes kinetics. So what do I mean by that? If I look out at all of you, I do not see a distribution of socks feet dimers and foot shoe dimers and foot socks dimers and stuff. Everybody, more or less, I like your style over there, maybe no socks, but more or less everybody looks like they did socks before shoes kinetics this morning. And the thing is that, for example, when a virus infects a bacterium, here's the virus, this is its DNA, it goes into the cell, it gets replicated, and the thing, only thing I want you to take away is that the viral capsid, the tail sheath, and the tail fibers are assembled separately. And then, when they're all done, they come together to make the new infectious virion. Just in general, there are lots of cases where kinetics is directed. It happens in a particular order. Okay? And I'm going to say that costs. This is a straightforward one. Do work. Energies. So what am I talking about? I'm trying to answer this question. What is the energy used for? I've given you like six things thus far. Do work. That's kind of mundane. Yeah?
You have 10 things in order. Is this order coming from expense of energy?
No.
No?
No, I think, I don't know. It just,
can you tell us something? Who is most important in energy? Who is next? So on, so on.
Yeah, I can. What I would say is that in a bacterium, that is 85% of the budget. 85% of the budget is associated with protein synthesis.
But that first one is not big?
The first one is big too, but this is the main player. Why they're in this order is kind of...
That doesn't matter.
Yeah, it's like my weirdness.
Who doesn't?
Yeah. So it's a great point, and actually, I'm glad you're asking that, because this is actually what we're all arguing about in cellular energetics. Where's Jonathan? Yeah, so Jonathan and Dan and I, like we were, maybe Mike, we're having some, I don't know if I want to call them differences of opinion, but I'm not convinced, I think they think a thing that they're overly strong on their point, like how important lipids are to the overall budget, and we still haven't had a chance to argue it out. Okay, they think they're right. I think they haven't heard me yet.
But we need to hear. Rudy count. For us, you can give something.
Yeah. So I guess I'm just, I also think that some of these cases we don't even understand. This one. I don't understand how much this costs. The thing I can tell you is just to put the DNA inside of here, one ATP per base pair. The genome is 48,500 base pairs long. So that's 48,500 ATPs simply to pack the DNA into the virus. But then to get this separate assembly and then doing them in the right way, I don't know how much that costs. And I almost don't even know how to formulate the question.
My gosh.
So you presumably do know what six costs. That's not
enough. I do. Yeah. So number six is something that people like Steve Block have measured using optical traps, where you hold on to this thing and then you look at the stall force and you figure out the speed as a function of the amount of ATP and that kind of stuff. So yeah, that's also why I said it's...
You count ATP.
You count ATP, yeah. That kind of thing. That's why I dismissed it as being a little bit mundane.
That's a few percent.
Let's see, what do I want to say about that? As far as the overall energy budget of the cell, again, I think that this is the kind of thing, you know, now that's Peter Foster's done a really beautiful measurement about this. My tendency is to say, I'm still going to be over here compared to the cost of that. Okay?
Do you have any molecular motor involved in the actual molecular assembly?
Absolutely. There's tons of them. So, you know, all the pieces of replication, which is copy the DNA, transcription, which is make the mRNA, translation, which is to add the peptides, that's four ATPs for every polypeptide bond.
So you can't really say that this is negligible because it's involved in that process.
Fair enough. I guess I was just thinking about this specific kind of thing, which is cargo transport.
Although I would say the motors in the macromolecular synthesis case aren't performing mechanical work. They're just moving against the fluid flow. And so the work is actually very low. But they're doing something useful.
What does it cost to destroy the protein?
Yeah, that's a great question. Okay, so David's question had to do with molecular degradation. And there too, I don't know the costs that well, but I would say a good order of magnitude idea is something on the order of 1 ATP per bond in return. You know, that kind of thing, if you want to go all the way. Yeah, often it's, you know, they get chopped into smaller pieces, but not all the way. Okay, let's see. These two, yeah, question? Okay, these two are the final two that I want to mention, and they kind of go together. They're different sides of the same coin. So number one is adaptation. Again, it's so easy to take it for granted. But you know, I think it's amazing that you can be on an island in the middle of the Pacific on a moonless night, and I could be standing next to you, and we could easily know who each other are. The North Star, the photons are separated by a kilometer. That's how dim that star is, you know, as they come to us. And yet you could be standing on Mont Blanc in the middle of summer with no glasses on, and I think it's, if I remember correctly, like 12 orders of magnitude different in terms of the incident photon flux. And yet, our eyes are up to the task completely. You know, it's not just our pupils. There's all sorts of clever adaptation that's going on. And this is true for all of our senses, and it's true for the senses of microbes. So here I'm showing you an idea associated with bacteria, which will swim up a concentration gradient to try to find the right or the better circumstances. And the way they do that is they have receptors. A receptor is a detector. And it's sitting there, and it basically figures out the concentration and uses that to alter activity. But there's something very weird about a curve like this. Like, let me give you a demonstration of such a curve. You guys are making me nervous, so here I go. So what did I just do? I increased the partial pressure of oxygen in my lungs. I saturated hemoglobin. It now went out in my tissues where the pressure is lower, and it released. The thing is that the curve, there's basically one curve. And so if I move back and forth across that set point, everything will be fine. But what if I change the concentration, the mean concentration, by a factor of 1,000? Then I'm either here or there, and it's of no use. So the thing that's amazing is that most of these molecules adapt, meaning that they take stock of their environment. They're like, oh, you tricked me. You changed the mean concentration. I will put some methyl groups on here, and I'll shift the set point. So that costs energy. Now, the flip side of this is homeostasis. There was a very interesting scientist/physician named Walter Bradford Cannon. I don't know how many of you've heard of him, but I suggest you go read about him today. So he was a professor at Harvard and a medical doctor, and he's the one who coined the term homeostasis. And what I find fascinating is he was intrigued in on the battlefields of World War I at why so many soldiers were dying of shock. And what he realized, when all was said and done, it had to do with the acidic content of their blood. And so, you know, I don't know much about this, and I'm quite interested in it, but there's super low tolerance for changing pH. This is not a joke, this epsilon. Like 7.32 to 7.42 is that's like the proper operating limits for pH. And I remind you what pH is. It's, you know, 10 to the minus pH is the concentration of hydrogen ions. So just to amuse yourself, by the way, pH 7 in a bacterium means 100 hydrogen ions. So there's all this effort that goes into maintaining the ATP to ADP ratio, the purine to pyrimidine ratio, our blood sugar. I mean, we're living in the era of diabetes and pH and so on. So homeostasis would be my last example. So that's what I have to say about number two. If you guys are cool with that, I'm going to erase my artwork and do number three, which is what physics has that biology needs. And I'm going to try and use a concrete example because I think it might be instructive as to the ways in which rigorous problem solving can be really useful for inferring general principles. So I want to hearken back to my former life in this building. when I used to come here, actually with Van Nederland's dad, and we would think about stuff like nano indentation. So this is just conventional material. This is an indenter, and this might be, I don't know, we could have a copper material or gold or silver or whatever, it could be silicon. And the thing that we're interested in is we're interested in the U of R, which is the displacement field. How much displacement there is a function of position. And so the way you would solve this is you could use the Navier equations of linear elasticity for an isotropic linear elastic material, just as an example. And you would find the green function, and then you could integrate over this profile. And what would come out of that is something that was worked out by Heinrich Hertz, which I find very cool. Hertz was such a versatile thinker, so that it's called Hertzian contact mechanics. So that's beautiful. I really love it. But here's the world that we, meaning the group that's here, are living in. I shouldn't have erased this one, so I'm just going to redraw it. So here's my chromosomes. And I want to comment on what happens when we bring an indenter into this problem. So there's some force applied to a spindle. So that's example number one. But I want to tell you an example I like even more, quite a bit more, which is, which I'm going to give the name of the sea lion green function. So this is something you can observe for yourselves. And there's actually some interesting videos to this effect online. And what I want you to imagine is that I have shoaling fish that are swimming around in a cylinder. You must have seen this before. We're talking 10 to the fourth fish all swimming around like this in a cylinder. And then along comes an indenter. So here's my sea lion, and I don't know how to draw a sea lion. He needs an eye. I don't know. I'm doing badly. But he comes in here, and he indents the fish. And the thing is that the displacement field is nothing like the displacement field over here. And I personally, you know, I'm kind of throwing it out there because Yuhai wrote this really cool paper on flocking and you know, collective motion of living organisms. And I'm just wondering, you know, can we figure out what the green function is for a point load, you know, one of these things? And how do, you know, these agents respond. But if you go look online, it's very interesting because I noticed this with coyotes and my dogs. You can shoo them and they'll move a little, but they won't move that much. It also happened to me with mountain lions. So the bottom line is that this thing indents, and I would like to know what the displacement is. So what am I telling you? What I'm telling you is that our instinct for concretely, rigorously solving problems like this is a useful part of the physics paradigm, where we figure out parametrically how things depend on the size and how it depends on the force and how it depends on the elastic constants of this material. You could ask all these same kinds of questions, and I don't mean to sound negative, but sometimes biologists would find that to be boring because we already know certain things. But you know, for me as a surfer, they would have, you know, referee three might say, well, we already know that tides are higher at full moon. But that's factual knowledge. And I think what I'm saying is that conceptual knowledge is of a different character. Like every 10-year-old surfer knows that high tide is larger at full moon, which is about to happen. Okay, so did I make any sense? So this was an example, and I guess what I want to add to it is attitude. So probably many of you didn't see it, but I recommend you go look at it. There's kind of this crazy guy at Princeton I'm sure David knows him well. His name is Bob Austin. He's an insane man. He and Adrian Parsigian had this really interesting debate in the pages of Physics Today. And Adrian wrote back in, he said, harness the hubris, Bob. And basically, Bob wrote back and said, F you, I don't know. I mean, I'm putting it politely, but, you know, he... And so I think what I'm saying is that I like the hubris, you know, like, we try to simplify things. We try to measure quantities. You know, there's a factor of 100 difference between different methods as to the number of proteins in E. coli. That's not okay. There will be no extrasolar planets discovered when your measurement error is a factor of 100. What else did I want to say about attitude? Attitude. Oh, let's see. Precision reproducible measurements, that a right measurement is an end unto itself. That's something that's not generally true in biology, in my experience. Universality, generality, abstraction. Carnot, Shannon, Maxwell, Boltzmann. More small scale example, Swift-Hohenberg equation for pattern formation. You know, like, there's generality and abstraction there that's really cool. The value of simplicity. Schrödinger in What is Life, and I've heard a few people say negative things about Schrödinger's What is Life since I've been here, but I'm not buying into that. 75-year anniversary. I think it's a great document. Actually, I think it's a document that was too far ahead of its time, and now is the moment to answer to Schrödinger. In his preface, he says, we have inherited from our forefathers the keen longing for unified, all-embracing knowledge. So I like that. Okay. So, what physics needs that biology has, part four. So, I want to tell you about a story that involves David Gross and David Merman, which I find really interesting. I put here a little reading list, which you can take a picture of. This is mainly just for your own entertainment. But this one's really fun. David Merman is a fun guy. He writes stuff that's worth reading just because he's interesting, thoughtful, and weird. So, I don't know the story exactly, but around the time of the turn of the millennium and also the 100th anniversary of Einstein, there was all this reflection on what are the big problems. And so this guy and many others took a crack at it, and the way Merman says it is that David said, I like to imagine that I'm Rip Van Winkle, and I woke up in the year 2105, and what would I ask? If I could, about what happened in physics. And so Merman, in this article, he's very critical about the questions. And I really appreciate that because, you know, think about it. In 1903, Kill Devil Hill, the Wright brothers flew, and 66 years later, people were walking on the surface of the moon. I can't wrap my head around that. We entered the third dimension in 1903, and 66 years later, Houston, you know, giant leap for mankind or whatever. So think about the words. Like if you told Kamerlingh Onnes, he makes a big deal about Kamerlingh Onnes. One of Merman's questions was, will people have realized by then that that's some one person's last name and it has two words in it? That's how Dutch people are. So, you know, superconductivity wasn't known in 1900. I don't know, some of the words in your other program, they're completely just from outer space. And here was the one that Merman wanted to know was, you know, will people be talking about the chronosynclastic infundibulum? You know, will whatever people are saying sound as ridiculous to us as, oh, I don't know, some string theory thing that you guys say? Okay, so why am I bringing this up? Because I actually have a really mundane thing that I feel is a key outstanding problem in physics that I would like to know in 2105, and I think that biology offers us the route to get to it, and it's this. So this last part I'm setting myself to get shredded, I worry. So what I want to say is that I think classical thermodynamics failed. You know, they had an objective, which was thermodynamics, and they ended up in the hands of Gibbs. And believe me, I am such a fanboy. Gibbs is my total hero, but it is thermostatics, after all. And then we have, you know, little linear departure stuff, and that's great. So what do I want to say or add about why the cellular energetics path might be a gift to physics in the form of a topic where we might be able to better understand non-equilibrium? So one of the people that intrigued me from the Bell Labs era, who I didn't know, I think I saw him give a talk at the APS, was this guy called Bernd Matthias. And Phil Anderson actually interacted with him a lot. And this guy was really clever at trying out new materials, I don't know, looking for superconductors and new kinds of magnets and this and that. And, you know, what I think I want to say is in condensed matter physics, we really depend upon the ability to make the materials to do what we want to do. And here's the pitch I want to make. We have incredibly exquisite control now over biological systems. We can do materials prep better in cells, in my opinion, than we can do thin film formation using the various trickery that material scientists have. So the reason is because we can basically, at will, go in and tune the DNA and tell it, make that protein glow red, make that protein glow green, turn the amount of that one up, turn the amount of that one down, kill off that one. You know, all of that stuff we can do at will. So I guess the thing I was going to maybe finish on was just to, I don't know, when should I stop?
Yeah,
I could stop now.
Five more minutes.
Okay. So our group, our cellular energetics group, has quite a few experts that are thinking about non-equilibrium thermodynamics. And probably many of you know that there's a lot of action. So there are things such as fluctuation theorems that are coming online, which have to do with quantities like this, where I might be interested in the probability of getting a flux that's going in the wrong direction. In other words, if I have two planes, and here I have N1 of T molecules, and here I have N2 of T, all of us would expect a flux like that. But in fact, you could get a flux in this direction. And I mean, I amuse myself by doing it. You four guys, raise your hand if you were born on an even day. So one out of three. I'm going to do it. If you're born in an even year. One out of three. You know, so when you have small...
What?
Oh, two. Okay, fair enough. It wasn't that hard of a question, Marty. Anyway, what point am I trying to make is that when you have small numbers, that you can get fluxes, if you like. You can get reverse pathway activated. And so what I guess I was going to suggest is that maybe, you know, I'm always intrigued by the idea that in the year 1800, there was no entropy. There was no electric field. People had to dream that up. Michael Faraday had to dream up the idea of the electric field. And, you know, in the evolution of physics, Einstein and Infeld claimed that the field concept was one of the greatest ideas ever had in physics. I mean, I'll let all of you debate that. But the bottom line is maybe we need new concepts. So I'm going to really put my head out on the chopping block by closing with one thought of a quantity, which, let me see if I can try to describe it to you. So this is T equals zero, the thing I just drew. So I have N1 of T particles here, and N2 of T particles here. This is my micro trajectory. So in a way, if you like, you could think of what some of the people in our workshop and elsewhere are thinking about is the statistical mechanics of trajectories, as opposed to a statistical mechanics of states. And so, you know, during this time interval, delta t, so this is time step of length delta t, then I would have maybe three particles flowing this way, and one particle flowing that way. And so a time delta t later, I would have something like this. So this is t equals delta t later. Okay, so what I want to do is I want to introduce something which I'm going to call the potency. And here, let me describe for you before I try to write down an equation, then I'm going to stop. So what do I mean by this notion of potency? It turns out that if you allow me to discretize space and time and particle number, then I can use binomial statistics to work out exactly all the 2 to the capital N microtrajectories in an instant, delta t. And what I want to tell you is that when the system reaches homogeneity, most of those microscopic trajectories do not change the macroscopic state of the system. When I'm in this state, almost all of the microscopic trajectories change the system. So I will define this as 1 minus what maybe I'll call impotency. And this, I'm going to say, is equal to this. So I'm taking some band around j equals 0 of width h, or 2h. And I'm saying all the trajectories that are within the fluctuations that I would expect even in equilibrium, those I will say are not changing the macroscopic state of the system. So if I take 1 minus this, it tells you how many of the trajectories are changing the system. And so here is N1 over total N. This is 1, this is 1/2. If you plot this, it does something like that. In other words, so what I'm plotting is what I'm calling potency. And when you're here or here, meaning that you're very far from the homogeneous state, most of the trajectories change the state of the system. When you're here, which is equally divided between the two sides, then basically most of the trajectories do nothing. Okay, I don't know. Maybe that wasn't helpful. I don't know. So let's see. I'm going to stop. So let me just see what my conclusions and summary are. Cellular energetics has its roots in classical thermodynamics and continues to be a super interesting topic. I mean, I've always wondered, why did physics give up on life? You know, people like Helmholtz, Thomas Young. Thomas Young thought of all of his physics, all of it, coming from his life as a medical doctor, everything that he thought about. Helmholtz, you know, was a medical doctor. He invented the ophthalmoscope, whatever, Julius Robert Meyer. So it has its roots, and I think it's time for us to get back to those roots. Organisms invest huge amounts of energy, and it's a really fun, interesting arena. I showed you all sorts of examples of how energy's invested. And my last point was, it's the holiday season, and I think it's fun to imagine that that physics is giving gifts to biology, and that biology is giving gifts to physics. And I suppose the final thing I would say, and you know, you might think it's corny, and I don't care really. No, but seriously, I think it's important to tell people that you love them. And I forgot who was here. Oh, you were telling Mike Lynch. You know, like, that's awesome. And it's really nice to tell people that they mean something to you. And so, you know, it's an amazing privilege to be at this place. And I don't say that. That's not some bullshit. That's completely 100% sincere. And I cannot believe. You know, I was an electrician in Santa Barbara. I put the electrical wiring in the Shah of Iran's house in Hope Ranch. I crawled around in attics for 4 years. So for me to be standing here doing this at this place is mind-blowing. I'm incredibly lucky. Thanks for letting me do this talk, and that's it.
Things in court, completely ordinary, you know, material
something like that in biology.
Yeah, I don't mean to be to make it sound trivial, but I'm really serious about how I feel that we're just so jaded by taking everything for granted. Like, almost nothing that you see in the living world do we really understand. Like, okay, so that's maybe too, okay, so what do I want to say? Like, to my mind, the greatest problems in biology have to do with evolution. Evolution is biology's greatest idea. That's point one. Point two, the greatest evolutionary force in the world is humans. So I'm giving you my honest thought. Like,
what do you mean by force in this case?
Well, in the sense of changing the nature of the biological world on incredibly rapid timescales. And that has to do with, you know, we can look at it any angle we want, whether we look at extinctions, invasive species, antibiotic and pesticide and herbicide resistance. Yeah, go ahead.
But are any of those questions not in principle or in fact in practice answered by just pointing out that, well, we have these huge numbers of degrees of freedom and that it's the way evolution has gone is very improbable on the
Yeah. So yeah, I'm gonna just keep humiliating myself. You know, I'm a huge fan of the 1972 More is Different, and biology is stuck in kinetic theory, and it does not understand or believe in phenomenological descriptions, higher order descriptions. So like, I think you guys, at point, you know, people that know about RG and coarse graining and getting rid of degrees of freedom, like, to me, that's a huge frontier area. And I don't know what it looks like. But, you know, maybe that's too abstract. If you want specific puzzles, get me the sea lion green function. Like, that's...
For one of the 8 or 9 examples you give at the beginning, can you explain how the energy is actually being used? I mean, harvested and used?
Yeah, so let's take the one of the concentration gradient, because that one is really straightforward for us with StatMech to just calculate the delta G, which is basically log of W, okay? So in that case, the energy is being consumed in the form of ATP, which is used in pumps, literally in pumps.
So how does it work? Like, you say it's a pump, but...
Yeah, okay. So, you know, there's one that's a sodium-potassium pump, and there's 3 of one species that go one direction, 2 of the other, and, you know, people solve molecular structures. I don't know what you mean exactly, but how does it work?
I don't know, like, the cell doing... I mean, I'm thinking of a pump, like...
Yeah, it's a configurational thing of a given molecule. It undergoes a conformational change in response to the consumption of ATP, and lots of molecular things are like that. And ATP is consumed, and it takes something and makes it go like that. You know, and really, I mean, that's what goes on.
I just have a question out of curiosity. You didn't address it. So you talked about homeostasis, which is a kind of local, keeping things balanced.
Yeah.
That requires energy. But what happens when you're starved for energy? How does the bacteria or us deal with that? I mean, that requires a kind of global expenditure of, you know, knowing what to shut down or not to shut down. How does that work?
Yeah, it's a really interesting topic and brings us to a discredited science, which is nutrition. No, but seriously, because the bottom line is, you know, like, which decisions are made about which pathways are going to be exploited depends on what resources are around. And so, you know, there are mice that are obese, that they can force them to consume their own organs. In other words, they've flipped the switch, which is like still in fat-producing mode. And so instead of consuming the fat, they'll actually consume the organs, if I remember correctly. So I don't think I'm enough of a professional to comment on it, but I can at least tell you something interesting to read by the brother of Cliff Taubes from Harvard. Yeah.
May I make a comment?
Yeah, of course.
So this related, as Rob saying, to adaptation. In adaptation, we actually know what happened when you starve the cell. And the energy in adaptation in that case is actually being used to do 2 things. One is to adapt with a certain speed. Another one is to adapt to a certain accuracy. And these 3 things are connected, the energy cost, accuracy, and the speed. So when you starve the cell, what happens experimentally, it actually maintains the accuracy and sacrifices the speed. I mean, that's what the phenomenon is.
Yes, please.
Okay, so I'm from Spintronics program and therefore a layman for the stuff you wrote on Blackboard. But you mentioned green functions, and like we can do green functions and all kinds of stuff, including non-equilibrium. And what would be exciting for, you know, us, let's say, to jump in as physicists is like a small well-defined problem rather than some kind of grand problem, evolution, meaning of life and things like that.
So one
example of a small problem that has caught a lot of attention over the past decade in the community of people doing non-equilibrium quantum many-body systems is, for example, photosynthesis. And it's a very controversial field because you see, like, you know, 5 years of papers saying we have experiments showing there's some quantum mechanics involved there, and then you have chemists coming and experimentally saying, well, it's not relevant, and I put it in the title of those papers and so on. And I look at this in those problems, and the stuff which is moving there is not my electron, and all of my green functions are formulas for electron. So nevertheless, over the past few months, I formulated the PET project which my student is working on, which is actually, I mapped all the stuff moving there, which is like excitons, and they have a commutation relation which are not good for all of my formalism because they do not satisfy standard bosonic or commutations. So I was able to map that stuff onto a nano-electronic device. Where I have two reservoirs, I'm shooting electrons, but they tweak everything to look like as if I'm moving those excitons. And once I have my electrons, then I can fire all the machinery of green functions, and I end up having a non-equilibrium density matrix, which I can follow on the scale of 0.1 femtosecond.
Cool.
And take a look. What is the off diagonal, which is quantum, what is the diagonal, and things like that. And it looks very interesting, and then one can address, you know, is there efficiency they talk about? Because the claim is that photosynthesis has a 99% efficiency because somehow quantum mechanics creeps into a system which is full of messy, finite temperature stuff, but quantum should not be there. So if I now start from that perspective, everything you have on this blackboard would be counterpart of photosynthesis, but for living organisms which do not do photosynthesis, because ATP and all this stuff, like mammals and, you know, animals. And so one surprising thing you never mentioned on the blackboard, mitochondria. So like in mitochondria, there is this proton pump process. And so the question is, like, if I want to do something similar to that, I take that process and I somehow shuffle it around so that I can make it amenable to my non-equilibrium many-body green functions, what should they set up? Like, what is the open, not understood problem of the proton pumping in mitochondria? This would be like amenable to me to fire all the machinery used in spintronics, nano-electronics, you know.
I'll try to be brief in two things. One, there's a guy in our group called David Baratan. You should definitely talk to him. I mean, he's really one of the world. Yes, he's right here.
Well, after this,
No, but he also just left the room, so he's not here right now. So I think that would be really useful for you to talk to him. And this is going to be maybe too philosophical for you, but, you know, one of the things that's awesome about physics is that the harmonic oscillator and the RLC circuit are the same thing. There's tons of opportunities for that kind of thing. Exactly what you're talking about. You know, you map one problem onto another and you solve some new thing. So, yeah, the sky's the limit, that's what I would say. So, have fun.
Yeah, so my question is just this notion of potency induced in the end.
Yeah.
Seems somewhat related to this entropy, like number of microstates for a given macrostate. Can you briefly comment on the differences / similarities?
I'm not sure I know. I mean, this is really almost like a throwaway to entertain you guys, but I'm intrigued by this. It's a snap back. I mean, you tell me. It's snap back of trajectories.
It's a curve and it's an entropy, right? That's what you're saying.
Yeah, but not. Well, yeah, maybe. Although the entropy looks like this. You know, that thing. That's actually what that one looks like.
You want maximal entropy, so.
No, I understand that. I'm just telling you. Like this functional form is the entropy at least of mixing, and this thing is. Anyway, we could talk about it.
So related to what you were talking about, what biology has to offer physics in terms of being able to modify DNA and tell, I'm kind of imagining that macromolecular synthesis sort of machine. So to what extent do you think in the next decade or 100 years we'll be able to construct use that sort of machinery, if you will, for constructing like semiconductors or silicon or things that are not actually in the human body. I'm assuming that for what you're able to do right now, you're only able to generate what is already in the body, like proteins or something like that, versus just monolayers of silicon or something like that.
I wouldn't even dare to say anything about 100 years, but what I can tell you is that people are on a rampage with being able to use artificial amino acids. You know, they've completely used all sorts of new synthetic amino acids, so they can reprogram the molecular synthesis machinery. You know, viral proteins, they can form layers, they can form cylinders, they can form icosahedra, they can form dimers. You know, there's.
But what about using particular atoms or molecules as the basis for making your
layers? Yeah, so do you know about this whole world of DNA nanotechnology?
No.
Yeah, so that's something worth your while to look at. You know, basically people can program, that's what's so amazing. You program the DNA and it will fold into a structure that you want. People have made maps of the Earth, they've made smiley faces, they've spelled out CIT, you know, whatever. So that kind of thing is definitely on the loose already. Big time. Not sort of, but big time. And there are definitely people trying to do the interface between the biological stuff and, you know, inorganic.
Thank you, Rob.